Hello, listeners, and welcome to Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. Not Selma or Patty Bouvier of The Simpsons.
Please, show some compassion for two good people who just can't stop smoking.
Still Scott Bland. Have a little bit of a cold, but I'm going to power through this week. Apologize for the little bit of raspiness.
Who needs Paris? This is our city of lights.
Anyway, this week on the Nerdcast, we're taking a look at the recent state election in Louisiana, a deep red state at the presidential level, but one with a Democratic governor they like and a Democratic governor who got reelected this past weekend.
Thank you. I love you. Now let's get back to work together for the great state of Louisiana.
We'll break down exactly what that result means, why it's interesting in a number of ways, and also why this doesn't translate directly into some kind of major warning sign for Donald Trump. Maybe a minor one, but it's not like he's on the verge of losing Louisiana in the 2020 election. But first, we are going to cover the impeachment hearings that continued this week. After three last week, we saw a ton more people testify before the House Intelligence Committee this week. Quick note before we get started, we are taping this on Thursday. This week, that is November 21st. So if anything notable or breaking happens after that, we're going to have to cover it after Thanksgiving. All right. As I said, we're going to start with impeachment this week. And here to talk us through everything we learned at the House Intelligence Committee is Natasha Bertrand, one of Politico's ace reporters covering this story. Natasha, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So I kind of want to break down what happened with the impeachment proceedings this week into four big questions. And then you can provide as many answers as you want to all of them. But the first thing that I've been wondering day by day and trying to wrap up for myself at the end of each of these days of hearings is, what did we learn from these public hearings, from this testimony, that we didn't already know from either the closed depositions that already happened or from reporting or statements that President Trump has made on Twitter or whatever? What did we actually learn that was new and potentially interesting this week?
Yeah, so a couple things. I mean, there hasn't been too much new because a lot of these witnesses, well, actually all of them testified behind closed doors, and all of their transcripts from those depositions have been released, and many of them kind of just went over what they talked about in their deposition transcripts. But a couple things jumped out, one being Gordon Sondland's testimony on Wednesday.
Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
He really implicated everyone.
Mr. Giuliani conveyed to Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and others that President Trump wanted a public statement from President Zelensky committing to investigations of Burisma and the 2016 election.
In this foreign policy back channel with regard to Ukraine, he said that this was not an irregular channel.
Did anyone else express any concerns to you about this so-called irregular channel?
I'm not sure how someone could characterize something as an irregular channel when you're talking to the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the Chief of Staff of the White House, the Secretary of Energy. I don't know how that's irregular.
It's something that everyone from the president to Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, to, you know, even people at the NSC were aware of. And this was not a back channel. We were not acting in a rogue way. And so he basically said everyone was in the loop on this.
Everyone was in the loop.
So that could have just been an effort by Sondland to protect himself, because obviously he's still in his position as the U.S. ambassador to the EU.
And also under a lot of pressure because he's now updated his testimony that he's given under oath several times.
Right. So that's another big reason why Democrats during the hearing, at least one anyway, Representative Maloney went after him and said, look, it's been really difficult to get the truth out of you.
Let me ask you something.
Mr. Maloney?
Hold on, sir.
Excuse me. I've been very forthright, and I really resent what you're trying to
Fair enough. You've been very forthright. This is your third try to do so, sir. Didn't work so well the first time, did it? We had a little declaration come in after. You remember that? And now we're here a third time, and we got a doozy of a statement from you this morning. There's a whole bunch of stuff you don't recall. So all due respect, sir, we appreciate your candor, but let's be really clear on what it took to get it out of you.
And he really grilled him hard on the things that were happening over the summer with regard to Ukraine. But I think finally, you know, Sondland felt like his reputation was being thrown under the bus, and he wanted to get out there and clarify that this was not something that he had been doing on his own. Another revelation was a change that Kurt Volker, the special envoy to Ukraine, the former special envoy to Ukraine, made in his opening statement during his testimony earlier this week. He changed his testimony from the first closed-door deposition to this week. He said that he was not privy to a conversation about investigations during a July 10th meeting at the White House. He said that he didn't recall just categorically in his first deposition that investigations were brought up at all.
Since these events, and since I gave my testimony on October 3rd, a great deal of additional information and perspectives have come to light. I've learned many things that I did not know at the time of the events in question.
And then this week he changed that and he said, yes, actually, investigations were brought up during that July 10th meeting and that Gordon Sondland brought them up and we all thought that it was very inappropriate, et cetera, et cetera.
As I remember, the meeting was essentially over when Ambassador Sondland made a general comment about investigations. I think all of us thought it was inappropriate. The conversation did not continue and the meeting concluded.
And then the final thing I think we learned, and probably the biggest one, is what was testified to yesterday by Laura Cooper, who said that the aid was – that the Ukrainians were aware of the hold on military aid as early as July 25th.
On July 25th, a member of my staff got a question from a Ukraine embassy contact asking what was going on with Ukraine security assistance.
Which is when she started getting inquiries from Ukrainian officials and the State Department about the military aid being withheld from the Ukrainians. And that is roughly a month earlier than we thought the Ukrainians knew, because obviously Politico was the first to report that the aid was being withheld on August 28th. And the Republicans' chief defense of Trump at this point has been that the Ukrainians didn't know until after it was made public by Politico that the aid was being withheld. So that was a big revelation.
That you know, you can't be bribing someone or holding a quid pro quo if they don't know that you're withholding something.
Yeah. So the Republicans' argument has been that the Ukrainians didn't know that there was a hold on the military aid. Therefore, when they were being asked to launch these investigations, they weren't being bribed or extorted in any way. Now we know that, in fact, on the day of Trump's phone call with Zelensky, the Ukrainians were asking about the hold on military aid.
And then, of course, we had someone testify in public this week who about a previously unknown phone call between Gordon Sondland and President Donald Trump that came out in another person's testimony before the committee that had not been known about in the previous closed door depositions.
Yeah. So David Holmes, who's a State Department official on loan to the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv, he testified today publicly something that he had testified behind closed doors last week, which is that he overheard the president and Sondland having a conversation.
It was quite loud when the president came on, quite distinctive.
Outdoors at a cafe in Kyiv.
Yeah, he clarified whether he was in Ukraine or not, and he said, yes, I'm here in Ukraine.
Over the phone about the investigations, the president essentially asking Sondland, is Zelensky going to do this? Sondland saying, yes, he would do anything for you.
He said, oh, yeah, he's going to do it. He'll do anything you ask.
He loves your ass.
And Ambassador Sondland said he loves your ass, he'll do anything you want.
That's something that David Holmes testified to, and that was further proof that the president was using Sondland as a kind of emissary for his desire to pressure Zelensky into doing these investigations into his political rivals.
And that disclosure is also interesting because it's one of the few so far that brings like a conversation with Trump directly into, but besides the phone call with the Ukrainian president, that brings a conversation with Trump directly into this alleged scheme.
Yeah. So this is someone who heard this firsthand. And that also has been a Republican critique of the process. They've said that so many of the witnesses brought by Democrats have been only hearsay witnesses and haven't had firsthand knowledge. Well, David Holmes testified under oath that he heard this conversation happen. And of course, Sondland yesterday also testified that he had heard this firsthand.
All right. Now, long answer to question one, but it turns out we did learn a lot this week. It wasn't just a rehash of all these depositions. So my second question is, what out of all those things do you think is the most notable or like sticky moment that happened this week that's kind of like most likely, at least in your analysis, to kind of stick in the public mind?
I think Fiona Hill's testimony on Thursday, God, it's been a long week, is probably going to be one of the most impactful because she is very authoritative in the way she speaks. She's very no-nonsense. And her testimony that there is no evidence that the Ukrainian government interfered in a top-down way in the same way that the Russian government interfered in 2016.
Based on questions and statements I've heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did.
That is going to have a lot of resonance, I think, over the next few weeks and months as the Republicans continue to argue that, hey, the president was justified in asking Zelensky to launch this investigation into the 2016 election. She categorically said she did not want to be part of that narrative and she did not want to help further the conspiracy theory that this had occurred.
This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves.
So that was a really strong statement. And then I just think practically, on kind of a logistical level, I think the testimony from the Pentagon official on Wednesday, where she said that the Ukrainians knew far earlier about the hold on military aid, that is going to put a big wrench in Republicans' arguments that there was no quid pro quo.
Got it. Third question. Now, does any of this information, has any of these revelations so far moved the needle within the Capitol on impeachment, specifically with any Republicans? I think like that's been a big question. Obviously, looking forward to the Senate, there will be a trial if the president is impeached. But also, presumably, Democrats would love to get someone else besides Justin Amash, who was a Republican but is now an independent, basically kind of over this issue, to vote for impeachment articles when they bring them. But it doesn't seem like anyone has put their foot out there yet.
It doesn't. And the thing that matters, obviously, or that will matter, is obviously the Senate trial. How many Republican senators can be won over in terms of impeachment? But from what we've seen from the hearings, the Republicans have very much seemed to be in line with the party's response on this, which is the president makes foreign policy. He was justified in asking Zelensky to investigate these things, and there was no evidence of a quid pro quo, bribery, or extortion. That's been the consistent narrative we've heard from every Republican. So there's no evidence that any of them are breaking away. That being said, it has been back-to-back impeachment hearings over the last 2 weeks. So maybe once there's a little bit of breathing room and time to absorb all of the testimony, we might see some cracks. But ultimately, it doesn't. It seems like this is going to be strictly a party line vote on impeachment in the House.
Mm-hmm. So at least as of right now, as at this moment, the House Intelligence Committee does not have any more depositions scheduled, although it's possible they could add something. So what else? What's next in the process? And what else is left for us to learn potentially from the calling of future witnesses, either here or potentially in a different House committee?
Yeah, so I think one witness whose deposition transcript we're all looking forward to reading is OMB official Mark Sandy, who is one of the people who would have had direct knowledge of the president's order to the Office of Management Budget to review the Ukraine aid and put a hold on it. Other OMB officials have so far refused to testify, and that has really – it's really hurt the Democrats' ability to get to the bottom of what exactly Trump said to Mulvaney and OMB and what his motivations were when he ordered that hold on aid. So that is, I think, another shoe to drop. But this is likely to be the last open impeachment hearing before all of this goes to the Judiciary Committee.
Got it. Yeah, that is interesting. And to the point we were talking about before with the conversation between Sondland and Trump that happened over that cell phone at the restaurant in Ukraine. They're really looking for more information about exactly what Trump did and when. That's been hard to get so far.
Yeah, they want to try to completely kill this narrative by the Republicans that the president did not have corrupt intent and that he was not asking for these investigations because he was trying to benefit himself personally and politically. So in doing that, they have really been trying to get answers from officials about the president's state of mind when he ordered the hold on aid and when he asked Zelensky directly for an investigation into the Bidens, because by getting to that intent, the Democrats will be able to show that this is someone who is abusing the power of their office.
All right. Well, Natasha, I know there's still proceedings happening right now as we speak, so I'll let you run back and keep watching those. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk through it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, for part two this week, we are talking elections. The 2019 elections finished off with a bang on Saturday in Louisiana. Why Saturday?
I think it's because they want to encourage voting. I mean, the argument to having an election on Saturday is more people can go and vote.
Yeah, and they've always done it this way in Louisiana. Anyway, here to talk about it, we have political reporter Daniel Strauss, who was covering the Louisiana governor's race. Daniel, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's run through the results in Louisiana from the ground up. We've got Republicans expanding their state legislative majorities. They re-elect the attorney general, elect the secretary of state. Everything's going well so far. But then you get to the very top of the ticket.
Louisiana's governor will keep his seat after fending off a Republican challenger.
He could not take the governorship. The state elected Democrat John Bel Edwards to a second term.
Edwards remains the only Democratic governor in the Deep South.
Daniel, why? And the answer is really about who John Bel Edwards
is. Right. It's all about branding. And John Bel Edwards has done what a lot of Southern Democrats have tried to do in running for re-election. He has created his own brand as being a different kind of Democrat, a conservative Democrat, one who helped usher in a very conservative abortion bill, one who is pro-gun, and one who often talked about going to the White House and working with President Trump on a number of issues.
Veteran, really good biography for the kind of biography you have to have if you're going to be a Democrat trying to win a state like Louisiana. And of course, he was already in office, having won in 2015. So he had the chance to build up some accomplishments like you just talked about.
Mm-hmm. And it also helped that in Louisiana, there was this jungle primary where there is not the usual nominating contest for a Democrat and Republican. In this case, everyone runs against each other at the same time.
And so then, you had a bunch of Republicans who were fighting with each other until just a couple months ago.
Right. And to be honest, the John Bel Edwards team really thought they might actually avoid a runoff and pass a certain threshold they needed to just win a re-election outright. But
yeah,
they didn't.
They got pulled into the runoff, but they still managed to win by, what, about 3 points?
Yeah, it's not a huge amount. But for a Democrat in Louisiana in this day and age, it's pretty good.
How sweet it is!
Now, it's actually not as good as his win in 2015, but there are some mitigating circumstances there, right? Like Republicans have been talking about Edwards for 4 years now as like, oh, he's the accidental governor, right? Why is that?
Because in 2015, his opponent, David Vitter, got caught in a prostitution scandal and Democratic forces released an ad with the tagline,
David Vitter chose prostitutes over patriots.
Prostitutes over patriots.
Now, the choice is yours.
Probably the most brutal political ad that I've ever seen.
Yeah, and this is also a part of, I guess you would say, John Bel Edwards' sort of image as a
stand-up guy.
A stand-up guy, a military man.
John Bel Edwards, who answered our country's call and served as a ranger in the 82nd Airborne Division.
He often goes to events with his wife, and the contrast with David Vitter in this situation was not helpful to Vitter.
Yikes.
Yeah.
And to be clear, Vitter wasn't caught in a prostitution scandal in 2015. It had happened many years before. He had actually won re-election to the Senate, but then when he tried to move over to this other office, the top job in Louisiana, things kind of went pear-shaped, as they say.
Went south.
Yeah. So this year, so Edwards beats Vitter in 2015. He spends a few years building up a set of conservative accomplishments, bipartisan. He's working with the Republican legislature. You mentioned he passed a very, very – or signed a very, very restrictive abortion bill, so restrictive that it got struck down in court and is currently still tied up in appeals. And so Republicans have been waiting 4 years for the opportunity to try and run against him and unseat him and take back full control of the government in Louisiana. And so the Republican they got to run one-on-one against Edwards this time was Eddie Rasponi, businessman, benefited from big support from President Donald Trump.
Yeah, multiple rallies.
Well, I just want to thank the people of Louisiana. You have been so great right from the beginning.
And sort of the same image as a businessman who's new to politics.
We need someone to do for Louisiana what President Trump has done for the USA.
But Eddie Rispone went into the runoff kind of bloodied up. He had this bitter rivalry with Congressman Ralph Abraham, the other main Republican in this race. And Republicans were divided in the state about who to support.
And so from the moment the kind of first round was over in October, the President Trump and the rest of the Republican Party really tried to rally around their new candidate. And I mean, these are big rallies. They had the candidate up on the stage. You've got Trump telling people, you have to turn out.
I want you to enjoy the game, but I don't really want you to enjoy the game if you don't vote first.
Right. I mean, the problem for Rispone was twofold. One was it was an off-year election, and that's hard to get voters to turn out. And second, his rationale for the case was not great. A popular opinion among voters and elected officials in Louisiana is that the Medicaid expansion that Governor Edwards put in place is working. But the critique in this election cycle was that there has been rampant misconduct. There has been misspending throughout the whole process, and Medicaid expansion in the healthcare system could be much better in the state.
But ultimately, I think just enough voters stuck with Edwards,
right,
on this argument. Now, what does this really say about Trump?
I mean, this is the latest example, Scott, of Trump being able to kick down but not punch up.
He's
throughout this presidency, we've seen him be able to knock down opponents, but he hasn't been able to really get a lot of main political figures, a lot of candidates, priority candidates for Republicans over the line.
Right. And we saw that in Kentucky a few weeks ago, right? Matt Bevin, pretty unpopular governor there.
Very close to Trump, actually.
Yeah, very close to Trump. And to Trump's credit, Kentucky, red state, he was able to pull Bevin up to the point where he almost won,
right,
but he couldn't quite do it. And it was kind of the same. Similar situation here. He's not so much working with an unpopular Republican as he's working against a popular Democrat in Louisiana. And Trump's pull was not enough to be able to pull Rispone past this kind of popular, unusual local figure in Edwards.
And ironically, of the three governor's races this cycle, the one where Republicans did win, Mississippi, was the one where the White House and Trump, I would say publicly, spent the least amount of energy and time.
Potentially because they knew they needed it the least,
yes,
though, right?
Right.
I think if there's one thing to draw about Trump here is that maybe if he was more popular, he would have been able to pull these candidates up, right?
He remains popular in these states.
He's popular in those states, but if he was like 10 points more popular, right?
Right.
If he was closer to 50% than 40% nationally, and so he was closer to, 60 or 70 in Louisiana than he is now, like maybe he would have been able to pull them over the line. But I feel like this does – so there is some national message or lesson there, but I think it's mostly like the power of these local races still having some, especially in non-federal races, still,
right,
having some pull,
yeah,
I think. Now, Daniel, you've got a story coming out this week about something really interesting, speaking of national implications, that Rispone and Republicans tried to use against Edwards, and it didn't really work. And for all the ways that you talked about that Edwards is a more conservative than most of his party, really kind of an iconoclast there, he's been a big leader on criminal justice reform and an icon to some on the left for his work there. Despite all the ways in which he's more of a conservative Democrat in a lot of core issues.
Yeah. I mean, during his tenure, he signed in some 10 bills meant to essentially change Louisiana's reputation from being an incarceration capital of the United States and lower the prison population by essentially forgiving some minor crimes, minor drug misdemeanors, stuff like that. And Republicans, the super PACs supporting Rispone, the Louisiana Republican Party, tried to argue that these reforms actually increased crime. It made the state more dangerous.
And soft on crime, that's an election message as old as elections, right?
Right. And I talked to a number of criminal justice reform activists, and they said, look, the fact that John Bel Edwards won re-election in the face of these attacks shows that the old tough on crime versus soft on crime attacks aren't working.
And that's a big message for the Democratic Party as a whole, right? You've got, just thinking back to the 90s and the rise of Bill Clinton and the we've been reading a lot and listening to a lot of what Joe Biden was saying about the crime bill in the 90s and the way Democrats were talking about it then, and this shift that we're seeing. Basically, reformers are taking Edwards' campaign and saying, if you can win in Louisiana, a very conservative or deep red state, if you can win on a what they call a smart on crime message there, you can go anywhere and do this.
I mean, right, exactly. The argument is that this would be such a tough state to go on a smart on crime, I guess you could say.
That's what they call it.
Yeah, that's what they call it. A smart on crime approach, you can win in other states. And truthfully, most of the Democratic presidential field have rolled out some kind of criminal justice reform policy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if we're going to see some fighting about that in 2020. Of course, it's not cut and dry. President Trump has signed a prison reform bill, and there's always talk about a criminal justice reform bill, a big one kind of coming down the line, although maybe that'll never really pan out.
Right. I mean, and I think that also helped John Bel Edwards in a way that
there was this kind of bipartisan.
Right. There was Trump takes great pride in this prison reform bill, and it's harder for Republicans to paint an opponent in a negative light on that issue when their president, their icon, ushered in something too.
Yeah, certainly a lot harder than 10, 20 years ago. One last thing. That we got to talk with every election that we're talking about in the next year, redistricting implications. So we talked about this with Virginia a few weeks ago. Edwards is going to be around. He's going to be in office when Louisiana next draws its congressional district. But there's an interesting twist here in that this doesn't guarantee him a role in the process because, as I mentioned at the top of the show, right, Republicans actually increase their majorities in the state legislature. And so they're very close. They'd only need a few defections to get a veto-proof vote on anything, but that potentially includes congressional plans.
Right. I mean, there's no sign that the state is going to get more Democratic or more liberal. And I guess you could say that John Bel Edwards is lucky that this is his second term instead of his first term with majorities like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess the one thing, you know, you could – I think there's room in the population in Louisiana to draw two majority black seats instead of one. And so we'll see – we'll see what ends up happening in terms of negotiations about that in a couple years' time in the state legislature there.
Yeah.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us to break down this fascinating election.
Always happy to break something down.
And as always, a big thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in this week. Hey, if you like that political discussion we had just now, there's a new feature on Politico.com that you're going to love. It's Politico's 2020 election forecast. Race ratings for every House race, every Senate race, every governor's race, every presidential battleground state in the country. We rated everything from solid Democrat to solid Republican. Got a lot of toss-ups in between with analysis to go with it. And this is a tool that's going to be around for the rest of the 2020 election. So check it out and bookmark it now. It's at politico.com/election-forecast. Our producer this week is Annie Reese with help from Jenny Ament. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Once again, thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.